Welcome to Out With Dan, the podcast that spotlights and examines the voices of LGBTQ+ authors, characters, and our allies. Together, we lift our voices and we tell our stories. I'm Dan White. Join me as I chat with this week's author. Hello and welcome back to Out With Dan. Today I am pleased to be talking to international and New York Times bestseller Anthony Horowitz. Anthony creates both adult and young adult books. He has also been awarded the OBE by the British government. His latest book is Close to Death. Welcome, Anthony.
Thank you very much, Dan. Lovely to be talking to you.
It's wonderful to be talking to you too. So this, give us a little setup, give my listeners a little setup of what Close to Death is about, and then we'll dive into it.
Okay, well, first of all, let me say that the title sounds a little bit morbid. I've only noticed while I've been interviewed this week that everyone says Close to Death, and I think, goodness heavens, that doesn't sound like a sort of a very entertaining book, but actually it's a play on words, because in Britain, a close is like a gated community, and that's where the book is set, in a very exclusive private community on the edge of London where various people are falling out with their neighbor. And that's the sort of setup for the book. But I need to explain that this is number five in a series that this is the sort of Hawthorne Horowitz series in which I team up with a detective and I am a character inside the book. For those of you who have read the book, you'll remember that there was the word is murder, a sentence is death, a line to kill, the twist of a knife. And it all revolves around a man called Daniel Hawthorne, who is a private detective kicked out of the police force for reasons that are sort of murky and unclear even to this day, who is now working as a private detective and needs a sidekick. No, he doesn't need a sidekick. What he needs is a writer. He needs somebody to write about him so that he can earn more money. So what he does is he invites me to write the books about him, to share the profits 50-50, and I become sort of his sidekick, the Watson to his Sherlock Holmes. So that sort of sets it up.
I love that. So where did you come up with the idea? Because all I could think of is picture within a picture. Remember those old TVs? That's what it reminds me of. It's almost like a picture in a picture because they're running at the same time, or at least a conversation is. So how did you come upon this particular idea?
Well, my publisher asked me about 5 or 6 years ago to come up with a detective series. We used to say a recurring character and a series of books, which I'm sure you know is sort of the golden grail for publishers.
Yes.
Because, you know, if you can get a Rebus or a Morse or whatever it might be, you know, you carry your audience with you. And I was sort of thinking, what can I do that's different? I'm a sort of writer who doesn't enjoy formula. I really try to do things differently, to try and do things from a new direction, because I've always said that writing is an adventure, that writing should be fun and it should take you to new places. So I sort of thought about, you know, who's going to be the detective? Is he going to be, you know, British or from abroad, black, white, gay, straight, male, female, tall, short, fat, thin, healthy, unhealthy? And I very quickly realized it had all been done. Every detective you want to imagine, somebody has written. You want a detective in a wheelchair? Well, there's Ironside. You want a detective who's dead? There's Randall and Hopkirk, deceased. There's been a vampire detective. There's been an alien detective. They have been done. So I began to think about the structure of a whodunit and the way that the writer is the cleverest person. So Agatha Christie or Conan Doyle, they know who the killer is before the killer does, because they've created the killer. They know everything. Then you get the sidekick, the Watson or the Hastings, who is less smart on the side there. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting if the writer and the sidekick sort of change places? So instead of being the cleverest person, Anthony Horowitz in the book is really the dumbest. I mean, he knows nothing. He's 5 steps behind the detective. And if the detective, Hawthorne, doesn't solve the crime, he doesn't even have a book. I mean, so there's a friction in the relationship. And I just thought this was a great way to do two things. First of all, to turn the whodunit on its head. Same clues, same red herrings and suspects and twists and turns and murders and a solution, but just from seen from a different direction. But it also allowed me to sort of look at the whole world of murder mystery fiction, to ask questions about how it's written and why people read it and all that sort of stuff, to look at it as it, you know, this is what is called, I think, meta fiction, where you're both writing a book and you are aware that the book is being written. And so that was sort of how I came up with it.
It is so delicious, and it's so wonderful because you sort of make a little bit of fun of yourself because Hawthorne keeps saying, I keep giving you all these clues and yet you can't put any of them together. You have climbing roses and parakeets, and that's very important to the character in the book. And yet what happens is there's a murder. There's more than one murder. And as I saw you being interviewed somewhere else, your book is certainly not a cozy murder because there's no such thing as a cozy murder.
That is what I've always said, Dan. You've been looking at my press.
I did indeed.
Listen, I love all murder mysteries and I love crime fiction, but I don't ever use those words of cozy crime or cozy murders because I don't think it is possible to stab somebody or strangle them in a cozy way. Murder is murder. And yes. So I think of my books as being, you know what I like to call them? I like to call them not even golden age murder because that's not quite right either. I think of them as sort of armchair murders, which suggests a little bit like Sherlock Holmes or Poirot in Five Little Pigs, where he doesn't even leave the room, you may recall.
Right.
These are murder stories that you can solve from an armchair. You don't need forensics, you don't need science and computers and you know, sort of examination of bullets and stuff like that. You can solve it just from the clues that are presented on the page. Armchair murders.
And as a reader, I will commend you as the author because I loved that about Close to Death because I felt like you gave us everything we needed to be able to solve it and you didn't trick us by giving it. I mean, red herrings are one thing, but tricking us by lying to us, you did not do that. You gave all of us the ability to say, I see exactly where this happens and what I should have seen back there.
I get very angry if I read a murder mystery or watch a murder mystery on television and I feel at the end of it that it would have been impossible for me to guess it. Now, I've just finished reading a book. I'm not going to give you the title of it. And that was exactly the case because it was beautifully written. I loved every single thing about it. But when I got to the solution at the end, I thought, well, really? Could I have solved this? Did I have enough information? Did the detective or the main character isn't a detective, but did the main character find things out sort of off screen? Sherlock Holmes does that occasionally, but even so, I love Holmes. But when it is absolutely impossible to guess, I get a little agitated. I like my clues to be in plain sight so that nothing pleases me more to hear that a reader has not guessed it. That's the first question I always ask. Did you like my book? Did you guess it? Occasionally I meet someone who says, yes, I did guess it. And I say, great, that is what it's meant to be. I'm still a little annoyed, but that is the idea.
I will tell you, I was really, really close. I was split between two, but I was really close. And I love, of course, we're not going to give it away, but I do love the way it ends. So I'm curious, how do you find Hawthorne, you as the author, the real author, how do you find Hawthorne? Do you find him to be a hero, a scamp, a ne'er-do-well? What is your take on Hawthorne?
Well, I've now known him for 5 books, and with every book I get to know him a little better, which I think is an interesting thing in itself, because when you're writing a long-running series, like, for example, the Alex Rider books, there are 14 of them, as you're writing a character, as the author, you just know him or her better and better with every book. You sort of ask questions, and somehow from somewhere the answers come. With the Hawthorne series, it's different, because I'm actually asking him, you know, what is it with you? Why are you so difficult? Why can't you be nicer to me? Why won't you tell me what happened to you in Reith all those years ago? You know, why can't you tell me who your friends are? And he's a blank wall. But the thing is that even so, I am getting a little bit more information. Like, for example, in Close to Death, we discover the organization which he works for. I am not the sidekick in this book because it's an older case. So he has a sidekick called John Dudley who seems to connect with his childhood in some ways and drops a few hints as to what has caused Hawthorne to have such a sort of a difficult life. But the main thing that's happening in the books, and it sort of almost surprises me, is with every book, I like him more. I can't stop myself liking him. And you know, Dan, that's a terribly important thing because I think it's impossible to read a detective story in which the detective is completely unsympathetic. You know, I always think about Sherlock Holmes, who is himself not the easiest of men. I mean, he's aloof, he's quite cold-hearted, he is extremely untidy, he takes cocaine, he doesn't read anything particularly or listen to music. But it is Watson's love of Holmes that makes the books work. It's that friendship. And I've just discovered sort of the same thing happening in the Hawthorne books. But although in the first book it was pretty rough going, now that we've got to book five, well, you know, we're still arguing. He still has views I disagree with. He still can be quite irritable. He still calls me Tony, which I do not like at all. But no matter how sort of how ridiculously unpleasant he can be at times, he is also likable.
Well, and I think that must be fun for you as an author, because you really do get to torture yourself and you get to pull in all the things that you don't particularly care for. I will tell you that, oh, I do want to show this because I think this is so wonderful. At the beginning of the book, there is a map that shows the neighborhood of the close, which I love seeing those, because not only do you give me the descriptions that I feel like I'm there, but with this map, I sort of get to physically see it and navigate my way around. And that's something that's so much fun for me.
I love that map. I'm absolutely overjoyed that we agreed to put a map in. I must tell you, I'm writing a new murder mystery at this moment, quite a big one, a sequel to Magpie and Moonflower Murders, the third in that series. And I just yesterday drew a family tree for it, which does the same sort of thing. It just sort of helps you. And I'm a great believer. Again, the book I've just read, I sort of lost track who everybody was. You know, there were like 20-odd characters in there. And I had to remember who was related to who and who was where when and all this sort of stuff. And I have, because I'm myself quite a sort of simple-minded reader, I like to be helped. I don't like to have to stumble. I don't like to have to think, oh my God, who lives where and you know, how do we get from A to B? I like you all in front of me. So I think a map is a wonderful device. And just sort of it invites you into the book.
It does. And it makes you feel like you've been there before. I mean, as I said, you as an author give me the descriptions that I can see where it goes. But when you have a map, you feel like you've visited this neighborhood.
Well, since you mention it, I couldn't write the book until I found the close. Now, I have just recently moved to Richmond-on-Thames, which is a very beautiful sort of, not quite a suburb, but it's an area sort of just outside London on the River Thames. It's very beautiful. Henry VII had a palace there, and it has a lot of connections to royalty. And I decided I would set the book there. And I went and visited a close that interested me, because it was a real gated community with a big steel gate that kept people out. But when I got to the other side of that gate, which I eventually did, legally, I have to tell you, I discovered that it wasn't going to work for the book. The geography wasn't right. I had to, you know, because there are lots of things in this book that somebody can see something from one house to another, for example, and you need to know that that works. So I looked around Richmond until I found exactly the close I was looking for, walked into it, stood there with my notebook, drew the houses, said, okay, I'm going to put the chess master's going to live in this house, and the bad guy who gets killed is going to be over there. I'm going to have the doctor and the barrister, the two little old ladies who run the sort of cozy crime bookshop. They're going to have that little house there. So as I wrote the book, just as you reading it with the map, I could not only sort of work out where everybody was, I could see it.
Yes, and that's nice. So there also, besides murders, you're have a lot of humor in your book as well. And I do want to mention one thing. So Roderick Brown says, do I look like a murderer to you? And Dudley says, well, actually. And I love that, because I did. I snorted and laughed out loud, because I'm like, there are little things that you bring into this. There's little bits of humor that you bring into this book to sort of break up the tension a little bit.
You're very kind to notice these things. And it's very important to me. You used earlier the F word for fun. And to me, yes, fun is an enormous part of what I'm trying to do. These books are entertainments. You know, they are about murder. There are some slightly sort of dark passages in them. You know, what happens to the two, without giving too much away, I think the two elderly ladies have a sort of a journey to make in this book. And yet, what I want the reader to take away is a sense of enjoyment and fun, because I have this feeling that in the world as we're living it at the moment, in what is happening all over the planet, people need somewhere to escape. I mean, frankly, I read now and pull the bedclothes over my head at night with a sense of this is a better world than the one that I'm living in. And I think that is what fiction does to a certain extent. So I want them to be fun. I want people to smile. And I do put jokes in there, sort of, you know, just a little edgy jokes just here and there. And they add a certain layer to the whole thing, I think.
I do too. And I think it that's yet another a little thing that you do to bring us in. You include us as readers in the fun things as well as the mundane things or the murderous things. You know, we're brought in to help solve a mystery. That's what all readers do with a mystery. We want to solve it. But we do not want to be constantly in a dark cave all the time. So the humor works so well because it is a lot of fun. And, you know, in life, we do have to have a laugh here and there.
Oh, absolutely true. And as there are different sorts of murder stories. There are some, you know, we were talking a little earlier about cozy crime, and I'm saying, well, I don't write that. I don't write, though, sort of violent forensic-based crime. I don't start with sort of, you know, a body with limbs missing, or I don't do sort of things, horrible things happening to women or to children. I try to keep everything, you know, in this murder, and this is not giving things away because you've already shown the cover, one of the characters is murdered with a crossbow. And even that already is saying to you, but this is slightly heightened. I mean, you know, I'm sure there are unfortunate people who have been hit by crossbow bolts, but by and large, it's a little bit sort of unusual. And so you're already dealing with murder as sort of almost an excuse for a story. I've actually always thought that. Murder stories are never about murder. They're about the people who are murdered and about the people who know them and the people in their community and all these relationships. Murder is simply an excuse, an invitation to investigate a community.
Yes, and you did that well. So do you have a favorite character? I mean, I know that's like asking which one of your children you might like the best, but do you have a favorite character?
Well, if you were going to take out myself and Hawthorne out of that equation, I would say that in the close, Adam Strauss is in many ways my favorite because he's a chess grandmaster. And it was quite fun creating that character. And not only that, but he's a chess grandmaster who has slightly fallen on hard times. And I love the fact that he used to be a minor TV celebrity with a quiz show, a chess-based quiz show called It's Your Move. And it's just, that title just tells me, I do not want to have seen that show. Thank you all the same. So I do quite like it. I'd say he comes up pretty high on my list of favorite characters. Although I think as a community, Riverview Close, where this is set, is full of interesting people. I also like the doctor's wife, who is a jewelry designer, but the only jewelry she designed is in the shape of poisonous insects. I mean, that makes me smile too.
It did indeed. And I thought to myself, what a twisted person Anthony is. I mean, really?
Well, these are all quite ordinary people in a way, but because that was the important thing, was not to gather together a sort of an ensemble straight out of Agatha Christie. So we don't have a vicar, we don't have a retired colonel, we don't have a mysterious millionaire. These are sort of people you might meet in the street, but all of them, I mean, even the dentist, we've got a dentist in there. That's a sort of fairly straightforward occupation, except this guy, Rodney, is a celebrity dentist and is so proud of having, you know, some stars on his thing. You know, I did the crowns for Ewan McGregor, he says, I think, or something. And that makes me smile too.
I loved that. I did. So you do something that I've heard everybody say that you cannot do, and that is to kill an animal. So you did that, but I think you redeemed yourself because it made us really hate the murderer even more.
Well, it's a very interesting question that you should raise that, Dan, because I was talking about that with my editor and last week in an interview as well. And it's sort of curious, isn't it, that kill a human being in a murder mystery novel, nobody blinks.
Right?
People get quite upset and uptight. And you honestly think, look, guys, this is fiction. This is not really happening. I have a dog and I love animals through and through. And I have a wife and I love people through and through. But people in murder mysteries die, and I don't see that it is. I mean, you can advise me, because in the book I'm writing at the moment, one of the characters has a pet, and I'm wondering if that might just, you know, make it to the final chapter. I don't want to you know, I've said my books are meant to be fun, but it does seem that this does upset people, this one thing. And maybe it's a mistake to do it twice.
Well, and I don't know, because one of the things that I've said, and because I know everybody wants to hear Dan's philosophy, is, you know, if there's a stray dog in the middle of the street, all of the traffic in Los Angeles stops while 87 people get out to help the dog. Yet we will pass by 87 unhoused people and never look twice. And I'm like, so there is an odd thing that, yes, we have this limit of what we can and cannot do in this world, but we also know that bad things happen to both humans and animals.
Well, it is a fascinating discussion, which I haven't had before with anybody. And I think it's a, you know, it does say so much about where our, you know, why is it even that way that you're absolutely right, that somebody can be literally dying in the street and people will just walk past, but a dog, they will stop for. And that figure you've just given me of 87 people, I mean, I can just see that. It's sort of, you know, I can see this great, and the internet is full of sort of, you know, sad dog stories always ending happily and everything, but no yes. one ever thinks about sad children and their sort of, you know, redemption and everything. It is fascinating, and it does teach me a lesson, which is maybe to, you know, to keep away from animals in these books. So just keep killing.
Well, It didn't bother me, but I know that there are people who just basically lose their mind over it. So,
well, the other funny thing is that a dog in the book belongs to a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine in the United States, the French Bulldog, and originally it even had the same name as my friend's dog. And I said to him, "Look, you know, I'm going to do this, and this is going to happen. Do you mind?" He said, "Oh no, I think it's a lovely idea. Do go ahead," he said. "It's hilarious." And when I changed the name of the dog, he was a little bit disappointed. But you know, again, it is not real. This is a murder mystery fictional Precisely. Story. Precisely. You know, I can put on the cover, "No animals were harmed in the writing of this book."
You might ought to. You never can tell.
But again, you've got to be aware of people's sensibilities. And I think it's a very, you know, it's a cautionary tale, what you've just been saying. And I'm listening to you, and I shall come away from this perhaps and make a few rewrites to the book I am working on at the moment.
So now I'm going to ask you a personal question, because I was the same way. You are not now. But so do you think that fat kids read more than non-fat kids?
Why do you ask that question?
Because somewhere along I read something that said that you were heavier when you were young and that you read a lot.
I don't necessarily think that follows. I think that I was a fat boy. Now, it's an interesting thing that in the world as it's lived now, that word is no longer used. And I think that actually, by and large, is good. I think that I am, you know, body shaming and calling somebody, insulting somebody because of their appearance is something we have left behind us. And I think that's, broadly speaking, good. It's quite difficult because in the book I'm writing at the moment, one of the characters, indeed two of the characters, it's the same person, in fact, in different forms, one fiction and one in real life, are both large women. And when I came to write that section, I found it very difficult to describe her without using language that might be deemed pejorative. And then I thought to myself, well, why even have that in the book? Because you'll make life easier for yourself if she's just slim or skinny or whatever word you want to use for the other side of that argument. But you see, where I think we get ourselves into difficulties is this, is that it is one thing to be respectful, one thing to be sensitive and to understand how other people think. And I think it's a good rule not to use bodily shape or color or health or any aspects as sort of an insult, make somebody feel like a worse Absolutely. Person. Absolutely. But at the same time, I don't think the writers should be censored from describing people who are different in their appearance or whatever. People who are maybe, you know, I'm not even sure if one's allowed to say disabled anymore. I think that word's gone out of fashion. It is difficult now to write about certain things, but I don't think writers should be afraid. I think we have got to be inclusive. And that means inclusive of, you know, you can have a person who is the killer who can be everything, anything.
Absolutely. Well, and I think your inclusion thing, we want to see ourselves when we read something. I was an overweight kid and I read a lot. So that had sort of my thing That's that I was sort of, that was my connection. But I do think that we have to be careful not to exclude things as well. I know how I weigh 205 pounds. So this is my size. So if I'm never described in a book as somebody who's 5'10" and 205, then I feel left out. So I do think that I agree with you. We have to have all kinds of characters to be inclusive and to be real.
I was a fat kid. There's no getting around it. When I was sort of 8 and 9 and 10 years old in my school, I was fat. I'll tell you a story, a terrible story. I've never told this before, but I will tell it to you. I remember that I was in a play. I was a lead actor in a play in my first year at this school. And the play was Dick Whittington, and I played Dick Whittington. And I walked onto the stage, and the narrator said, "Oh, here comes our handsome hero." Those were the lines. And I walked on, and the entire audience dissolved into laughter. that was because I was a fat kid. I wasn't the handsome hero. I was this little waddly boy. And that, to tell you this story 60 years after it happened, tells you what it, you know, but it left a scar in my memory. And it so does. In my books, I will not have that laughter. I will not have a woman who is of a larger size laughed at for that. It's her choice, or it isn't her choice, but it is how she is, and it doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. You know, you don't make it the motive for a murder. You don't make it the motive for a killer. You don't, you know, you just have to be sensitive and aware, but at the same time, you must be allowed to include it if you wish.
I agree with you. I agree with you. One thing, so you did, I'll tell another little humor thing. You said of one of the characters, she might have turned heads. I love that, because I thought, okay, so she might have, she might not have, but you felt like, I felt like I knew the character. I didn't feel you were making fun of the character. I thought you were giving us a bit of the author's idea of what this person looked like, and you did it with such love and kindness.
And actually, you know what follows? It's a line that follows that gives its slight sort of poetic edge. It says, she might have turned heads, she might have turned every head in the room, but that was a different room and another time. And that's what I'm actually going about. It's a memory of, yes, of that type of beauty. And I think that expressed like that, there is a sort of an understanding of who she is.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I do think, you know, with strong characters, they often own the room they're in because of who they are. And we find that in real life. I mean, sometimes the person just needs to be sure of themselves. So they get off the room, notices a person who's sure of themselves. They rarely notice the wallflower. So I think it was a lovely description.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I will say one other thing, Tenny, which is that in the first book, Hawthorne has some very objectionable views, which are based on people's sexuality and on their appearance and everything else. And it's one of the reasons in the first book, which I find it so difficult to work with him. But it was a deliberate choice to do that, because I believe in the writer's license to create bad people. Hawthorne, yes, first book, is a bit of a bad person. And I'm trying to work out what made him bad, because people don't become bad by choice. You know, it's nature, it's nurture. And I'm always fascinated in what turns somebody into, you know, a phobe of one sort or another. Somebody who has a dislike of a type of people or of anything, or somebody who does evil in the world. I've written plays and books about, you know, famous villains. And I'm always interested in why, what choices made that. If you don't ask those questions, if you don't tackle those issues, you are never going to make the world a better place. You have to understand people's bad feelings in order to bring them back, as it were, into the light.
I totally agree. And of course, when you're writing a series of books, we, the readers, want to see the characters evolve. We want a new arc in every book, because that's what you are going to bring us as an author. And if the character starts off bad, you give them an ability to sort of become better as time goes on.
Or not. I mean, one of the
or Alex not, Ryder, or not.
My favorite Alex Rider book in many ways is Russian Roulette, which tells the story of a young boy called Yasin, who is a perfectly nice, ordinary kid growing up in the Soviet Union, or, you know, under communism. Well, actually, no, just after the fall of communism. So it's the time of the, you know, when capitalism comes in and the mafia starts in Russia. And he develops and grows and becomes an assassin. And by the end of the book, he is a paid assassin. And it's the story of his journey. There's no redemption, but what there is understanding. And that's why I like that book.
I love that. So, Anthony, do you have social media or a website you'd like to share?
Well, you can find me on, what can you find me on? No, not really. You can find me at Penguin Random House. I'm one of their authors. I'm afraid to say I have just recently resigned from X. I found the whole website a little bit too dark for my taste, so I have gone. So I'm okay. Not that easily found.
All right. Well, that's all right. It'll be a mystery for my listeners. They will have to dig through the mystery of finding you.
AnthonyHorowitz.com exists, and that's, yes, my own website.
That is,
and
yours, yes.
That's uncontested.
And they can find you right here on Close to Death, your latest book, number 5 in the Horowitz and Hawthorne series. So thank you so much for joining me, Anthony. This was an absolute pleasure.
I very much enjoyed talking to you, Dan. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining me for this week's episode of Out with Dan. You can find more information about this podcast and its host at outwithdan.com, on Twitter at @outwithdan, and on Instagram and Facebook at @GoOutWithDan. This podcast is hosted by Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and the theme music is provided by bensound.com. Join us again soon for the next episode of Out with Dan.